Good morning, New Mexico, and welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting live from the Santa Fe Baking Company on Cordova Road and streaming on the web at ksfr.org. We're also podcasting. The website is santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can listen to the show anytime you want, including archived shows back to the beginning of the year. All of this thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services. And you can also subscribe to the show on iTunes. Well, we are continuing with our fourth day devoted to the Santa Fe Film Festival, which got underway with a bang yesterday and is running all through the weekend. Today, we're going to be talking to five different people about five different movies. And the first three are from what is called the All Roads Film Project, and that is from National Geographic. It's a project with the intention of letting indigenous and minority culture artists share their cultures and stories and perspectives through film and photography. So there's films, three of which we'll be talking about today, and a photographic exhibition, which opened last night at the Center for Contemporary Arts. And there's a concert on Friday. And in fact, let's start with that concert. We're giving away two pairs of tickets today, and we might as well do it now. And it's a concert of Tinari Wen, which is at the Lensic this Friday at 7 o'clock. Guitar poets from the Southern Saharan Desert. They play a fusion of Tuareg folk songs with electric guitar. And it's a modern desert rock sound that mixes blues and rock and pop. So it's called Tinari Wen, and if you want to go to it, we've got two pairs of tickets, and Laurel is standing by for your call, 428-1382. I would like now to welcome Billy Luther. He is the producer and director of a film called Miss Navajo, and we actually also have Crystal Fraser here, who is one of the contestants in the Miss Navajo pageant. Welcome.
Thank you for having us.
Yeah, thank you.
It's great to have you here. This is such an interesting concept. I didn't even know that there was a Navajo beauty pageant, and beauty is really the smallest part of it.
Yeah, that's the surprising thing, is that this pageant's been going on for over 50 years, and many people haven't heard the Miss Navajo Nation competition. So this is a great opportunity for this documentary to give that pageant platform. It's not just about looks and bathing suits and ball gowns. It's more about culture and skills of traditional Navajo women.
Now, the pageant started in 1952. How did it start? I mean, it seems like such a sort of 50s American archetypal thing.
Well, it did start out as a beauty type competition, from adopted from the Western eyes beauty concept. But I think a few years later, the Navajo people realized that they could do something really different with this pageant and show different talents and skills of Navajo women. So it really went into another direction. But it did start out as like a popularity contest.
Crystal, how did you decide to get involved with this? What attracted you about the idea of doing it?
I was actually the current reigning Miss Northern Navajo, which is representing one of the five agencies of the Navajo Nation. You know, Miss Navajo represents the Navajo Nation as a whole, but I represented the Northern Agency of the Navajo Reservation. And so it all started, as you will see in the movie, from a dare. And but to run for Miss Navajo, you know, it's, I guess, once-in-a-lifetime opportunity for some people. And to have an opportunity to be part of a filmmaking process, I mean, why would you turn that down? That's once-in-a-lifetime, too.
So there were quite a number of contestants in it, and, Billy, you chose to focus on Crystal and her story as she progressed through this whole competition.
Yeah, I thought with Crystal, she was a tomboy, and it was totally against the whole notion of what people think of as beauty-type contestants with hairspray and makeup. Crystal was total opposite about that, you know. And really, you know, what made me want to do this film was my mother. She was Miss Navajo in 1966, so that was my personal connection to it. So growing up, hearing these stories from my mother just sparked my interest as a filmmaker to do this story.
And you have her in the film?
Yeah, she's featured in the film.
As well as a number of other former Miss Navajos.
Yeah, we used their interviews as to give context to their life on the Navajo reservation, but also to sort of explain to the viewers and to audiences what necessarily a Miss Navajo contestant goes through.
And by the way, ladies and gentlemen, the film is screening tomorrow morning at 9:15 at the Indian Arts Museum, the Museum of Indian Arts and Culture, and then again on Sunday in the same place at 4 o'clock in the afternoon. What are the things that you have to be good at? What are you judged? What basis are you judged in the Miss Navajo contest?
Well, I think it, like Billy said, it follows your typical beauty pageant format. I mean, you had, with Miss Navajo, you have a traditional and contemporary competition in which you have to have a skill and talent in both. You do public speaking, you do an impromptu question, and then there was a ball gown competition with the part of the contemporary, and then the same in the traditional, and of course, traditionally you have the sheep butchering competition that's part of it. And,
so that's not, I mean, that was really unusual when I was watching the film, sheep butchering as part of a beauty pageant.
Oh, yeah. Me, I grew up watching it. You know, that's just part of our culture, our way of life. And I have memories of early years, you know, of seeing my grandmother, my mother participate. And, you know, eventually as we got older, you know, we were all expected to take part of it.
So is butchering a women's activity?
Majority. Yes, but, you know, everybody helps out when it's done, so.
So, one of the other aspects of it is you have to demonstrate fluency in Navajo language.
Yes.
And one of the poignant aspects of the film is that Navajo language was really drummed out of people through the boarding school process and other things. And one wonders how much more Navajo language fluency there would be if that hadn't happened.
Yeah, well, the interesting thing about the Miss Navajo competition when my mother ran was they were more fluent with the language, and the pageant was more judged on English and speaking English because everybody spoke fluent Navajo. So everybody was judged on their fluency of English. Now, today, you see it's the reverse, it's the opposite. You see the young girls speaking fluent English, but also struggling with the Navajo. So it is an important part of the competition, and I think to be Miss Navajo, one should speak the fluent language.
Is the fact of being judged on that a motivation for people to get better at their language?
I think...
How's your Navajo language?
It's better than what it used to be.
Well, that's what I was wondering.
For me, it wasn't, I can't say it was because of the Miss Navajo pageant. I mean, it was something that I had embarked on long before I even decided to run for any kind of pageant, you know, Miss Northern. And so it, I think for me, it was more of my post-high school experiences, you know. I do remember recalling asking my parents why they didn't want English as our first language in high school, and I think the notion back then was it would interfere with your learning process. You know, they struggled with, you know, they were fluent Navajo speakers and they struggled all through high school, and you know, they're college graduates, but they just felt that it'd be easier, you know, for us if we mastered the English language. And so for me, it, like I said, it was already in the process, and I guess you could say the pageant process in whole, including Miss Northern, was just one of the stepping stones, and I guess in a sense forcing me to really get comfortable speaking Navajo.
And what I learned also with the contestants who ran that year I followed Crystal was a lot of them struggled with the language, so it was I think it was sort of the motivation to jumpstart their seriousness, I guess, if you could say, in relearning the Navajo language.
And eventually, presumably, teaching their children.
Yes, yes.
Another thing I really enjoyed about the movie is that not only is beauty not that main thing, or you expand your concept of what beauty is, but there's also not this, you have to be a skinny girl with this certain kind of body thing. There's, I mean, among the finalists, there was some women who were, you know, larger, women who wore glasses, and it was really a beautiful thing to watch.
I thought that was really special, too, when you saw different shapes and sizes of Navajo girls competing in this competition, because, you know, they're all beautiful, and I think we, you know, in America, we think of the Tyra Banks, America's Next Top Model, as beauty, and with the Miss Navajo, you know, I think outsiders, non-Navajos would probably say, oh my gosh, who, you know, who's running for this pageant? But I think it's all of them have a special, unique quality, and beauty is internal.
Well, it's a wonderful film and an excellent piece of filmmaking. Billy Luther is the producer and director. Crystal Frazier is one of the contestants. And it screens tomorrow morning, Friday, at the Museum of Indian Arts and Culture, and then again on Sunday at 4 o'clock. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Oh, yeah, thank you.
We're going to hear a little bit from our underwriters right now, and we'll be back with more from the All Roads Film Project. Stay tuned to KSFR. I'd like now to welcome Alanis Obomsawin. She is a filmmaker, and her film Wabanaki, People from Where the Sun Rises, screens tomorrow at the Armory for the Arts. And she is one of the tributees of this year's Santa Fe Film Festival. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you very much.
It's wonderful to have you here. This is a very interesting film about the, well, where is the homeland of the Wabanaki people?
Originally, our land was all of New England, the Maritimes in Canada, the Maritime provinces, and the southern part of Quebec. It was a very large population of different groups, having different names, but all belonging to the larger nation, which is Wabanaki.
And it's a very loving documentary that you've made, which seems very personal. There's a lot of memories and a lot of sense of nostalgia that comes into it, as well as information about your people.
Yes, it's my reason for doing it is really to make sure that our history is known by the young people that are living now, also the ones that are not here yet, so that they will know where they came from and all the history that occurred before they were born. I think it's very important for all nations to make sure that their traditions and their history is known by its people. I think people whose history has been denied makes it very difficult in life. And I think a country who denies the history of a people is poorer for that movement, what it does to a nation.
What are some of the traditions that you think it's most important to tell the young people about?
I think all traditions are differs from...
But I mean, of the Wabanaki people.
It's not just tradition, it's the culture, and it's what's happened to the people to understand why we are where we are now. It's very difficult to understand otherwise what has happened to your ancestors. How did you get where you are now? And all these laws that were made, especially for our people, which is called the Indian Act, is full of very oppressing reglementation that is made there for our people, but it's really against.
Well, one of the things that was amazing watching the film is to see that if a woman, for example, married a non-Indian man, then she lost her rights, and she was neither a Canadian or a Canadian citizen nor a person with tribal rights. It was shocking. There was a whole long political fight to get that back.
Yeah. This particular law was there for over 100 years. So you can imagine how many generations were very sick because of it. And not only that, but if the man married an outside person, that person became Indian in terms of law. And the Indian woman lost their rights, and a white woman came in and received the rights. So you can imagine what it did in families. Brothers and sisters, blood related, were no longer of the same family. So there was a lot of exclusion and rejection that has happened to a lot of people.
And some women chose not to marry, but to have their families and have children, and then on the birth certificate they would say father unknown, even though the father was right there next to the child as it was being born.
Yes. A lot of the women did that because that way they could keep their rights and so would their children. Otherwise, if they didn't, they'd lose their rights and the children had none either.
And so is it, how are things now? Have the worst of those laws been changed?
Yes, since 1985, a new law came in and it was called Bill C-31. And in there, all the women who lost their status could take it back, and their immediate children would receive the status. But if, and they have numbers, like it's 6-1, 6-2, 6-3. 6-2, it means that there's one parent that is not native. 6-3 means that you, as a number 2, which has one parent that is native, your child, if you are to marry outside, your child becomes 6-3, therefore there's no rights. And again, it's an oppressing law because it dictates whether you can inherit from your parents or not.
Not to mention that you are turned into a number.
Yes.
We're talking to Alanis Obomsawin, whose film is called Wabanaki, People from the Rising Sun. There's also some a theme in it about canoe making. Yeah. And traditional birch bark canoe making, which is very slowly and lovingly described and shown.
Yes, when I was a young girl on the reserve, all the men made birch bark canoes or very bulky big baskets out of spruce bark or birch bark. And the women made baskets. And it's really from the basket making that in the early 1900s and late 1800s, our village was built with the most beautiful homes. The people earned the money themselves and built this village. And then later on, every summer the village would become totally empty because the family would go to somewhere in the States, to New England, you know, before there were borders. This was our land. And they would set up a little store and sell their basket on demand. Like in those days, people would come and say, I want a basket to fit a corner, and it has to be red and blue and so high. And they would just make it to order, to what the people wanted.
And they could make a good living.
Yes, they did very, very well. And then there began to be problems going across the border, and a lot of people stopped traveling. And then in Canada, Indian Affairs took over this business. And they would have like a little store on the reserve, and they would also sell the ash and the sweetgrass to the people. So the system was like the Hudson Bay store. They would mark down what the supplies that you bought from them. And then when you would come with five dozens of baskets, then they would say, okay, you owe us this. So at the end, the people would end up having not very much money. And also, the system changed because now Indian Affairs was ordering baskets by the dozen, the same, which previously that wasn't the case.
So what are... Well, when you show this film... to your people, what has been their response?
It's just incredible. Like when we went to the community to show the film, it was such a moving experience. Like I knew everybody quite well, and I never saw them before to be so expressive. And, you know, it was just a gift to see how happy it made them. And also secure the history for the children. It was very a very rich experience.
The film is called Wabanaki, People from Where the Sun Rises, and it screens tomorrow at 5 o'clock at the Armory for the Arts. And you have another film also.
I have three films on Sunday.
Oh, you have three films on Sunday.
Yes.
And they screen when?
They screen at 11 a.m. is Richard Cardinal, Cry from a Diary of a Métis Child. This is a story about a young man who committed suicide at the age of 17 after having been in 28 foster homes from the age of 4 to 17. And Genie Boy Came Home is the last film I made. It's about a man who went to Vietnam. And it's about his story and the destruction of his life. And then Palm Maker's Lodge is about a center in Canada that was created to help out people on the street, people who had drug and alcohol problems. And it's been extremely successful, so much so that many people have gone there to get the experience, be a counselor, and go back home and help their own people. Because there is a very strong component of traditional ways and spiritual ways of the people as part of the curing
right.
of the problem. Yes.
And all of this is on Sunday at 11 in the morning.
A.m. And this is at the Center for Contemporary Arts.
Well, I want to thank you so much, Alanis Obomsawin, for being with us here on the Santa Fe Radio Cafe.
Thank you.
And congratulations on being a tributee of this year's Santa Fe Film Festival.
Thank you very much.
We're going to take another little break. Stay tuned to KSFR. And I'd like to welcome now our friends from a film called Super Amigos. We have Arturo Perez Torres with us, and we have Super Barrio. Bienvenidos.
Gracias.
Buenos días.
Now, this is a very interesting film. It's kind of a combination of documentary, comic book, animation, and kind of staged scenes with these heroes, of which you, Super Barrio, are one. They're actual superheroes who wear the costumes of professional wrestling, lucha libre, to deal with some of the problems that are going on in Mexico, and particularly Mexico City.
That's right.
Tell us about this whole phenomenon.
There are five guys. They call themselves social wrestlers. So what they say is that they're wrestlers, but instead of fighting in the ring, they fight in the streets. And each one of them has a, kind of like a very particular cause. Like Super Barrio here with us, he defends tenant rights. And then we have Super Animal, animal rights, Super Gay, gay rights, and Ecologista Universal, who defends the environment, and Fray Tormenta, who defends street kids, which is a big problem in Mexico City. So basically, like you said, these guys take the whole personality of a wrestler with the whole costume, the mask, and they just act in the streets, and nobody knows who they are. So they almost are like the anonymity of a comic book superhero, and they just do
and they actually,
them.
I mean, it's almost unbelievable. They actually go around fighting crime and corruption.
That's right, and nobody knows who they are.
Now. Usted no, ahora no está usando su disfraz, su máscara, pero normalmente lo usa. ¿Y por qué esta anonimidad? Why this anonymity?
Bueno, es una forma de representación colectiva de derechos. La gente a veces siente representada en alguien donde no hay un rostro de por medio, porque el rostro de mío y el rostro de todos mis compañeros que luchan por distintas causas es el rostro de todos los que participan, y es una manera colectiva de unión, de solidaridad, de apoyo para la gente en una comunidad poderse defender unos a otros, ¿no?
Do you want to translate a little bit?
Well, basically, it's about the mask represents everybody. So there is really the who is behind the mask. It doesn't matter, and people sometimes they just need kind of like that symbol to feel represented and to feel that they belong to this community.
And it's very much of a collective as opposed to an individual.
Exactly,
ethic.
It's all about collective. That's I think what is very admirable. They do it almost in an altruistic way.
One of the things that was sort of disturbing was the stories of one of the people, I think it was Super Barrio, when he was young, went to the Catholic Church for help, and the priest kicked him out of the church.
Yeah, that's right. It was actually Fray Tormenta.
Okay.
And he ended up becoming a priest himself. So it's funny because he didn't hate the Catholic Church as an institution, which he could have, right, after his experience. But he decided that he still respected it and all that, but wanted to be different and make a change. So he became a priest and helped kids with his wrestling. And, you know, it's kind of like Lucha Libre, the Jack Black movie was inspired by him.
The one of the things that they've taken on, let's see, Super Animal, is bullfighting. I would think that's a hard fight to win.
Oh, yeah. I think it's impossible. I mean, most Mexicans see bullfighting as part of the culture, unfortunately. So when you talk to an average person in Mexico, they would go like, why? I mean, it's like fighting against tequila or tortillas. It's part of our identity.
Right.
I mean, he's crazy. So they cannot separate animal cruelty from bullfighting. So he's got a tough fight.
When these superheroes go and do their thing, part of it has to be for media reasons, that you get good press, that people take pictures, that people write about them. How is that working out?
I think that's they're very smart, because they know that the only way to get around and to get through people is through the media. So they work within the system, and they're very media savvy to get attention. They do press releases every time before they're going to do an intervention. And they know that the way to get their cause out is by using the media, so by using the system. And they're great at it.
And so many people watch professional wrestling and have even a love for that, or a connection to it.
That's right. They already know. I mean, professional wrestling, lucha libre, is the third most popular sport in Mexico.
Is that
after
right?
Soccer and boxing. So it's, I mean, people love it. So they already have kind of like the battle one. When they see it, people already identify. They don't have to explain themselves. It's like, okay, he's clearly a luchador. So,
Super Barrio, you go into neighborhoods where people are being evicted from their apartments, where their buildings are going to be gutted and turned into hotels and convention centers and things like that. And many people, if that happens, will be left on the street. Cuéntanos un poco de su trabajo de defender inquilinos in barrios donde quieren hacer hoteles y centros de convenciones, etc.
Bueno, esta es una cuestión histórica. De ahí surge gran parte de la lucha inquilinaria.
This is a historic problem that has been for a long time, and that's where the tenant fight defend began.
Antes de 1985, hay una tendencia en la Ciudad de México de expulsar a los habitantes de las áreas centrales de la ciudad.
Beginning in 1985, there was a tendency to kick people out of their places, especially in the downtown area of Mexico City.
Ahora, el terremoto de 1985, que destruyó una gran cantidad de viviendas, si bien fue una tragedia, puso las condiciones a favor de los inquilinos para la defensa de la vivienda y de los barrios.
In the earthquake of 1985, it was the trigger that obviously it was a tragedy, but it was the trigger that started a movement that made tenants more conscious of their rights.
Resultado de eso, se han construido por los movimientos y por las comunidades más de 80,000 viviendas nuevas en la Ciudad de México de carácter popular para gente que las iban a expulsar por la especulación inmobiliaria y que lograron defender sus viviendas y los barrios, la integridad de sus barrios.
So as a result of the earthquake and with the movement, there has been more than 80,000 houses built. And these are social housing, so for people with very low income, and they have now a house out of the result of the earthquake.
So Super Barrio has been very much their defender. How do the police react to you? ¿Cómo reacciona la policía cuando ven un hombre grande y con este disfraz de lucha libre?
Bueno, yo ya, Super Barrio ya es parte de la iconografía de la ciudad y de la cultura.
Toda la gente la conoce.
Sí, desde los taxistas, la gente en la calle, sale Super Barrio y ya saben que está Super Barrio. Al principio fue difícil con la policía.
Today, Super Barrio is part of Mexico City. Everybody knows him, from the taxi driver to the policeman. Everybody knows who Super Barrio is, so he's part of the iconography of Mexico City. But at the beginning, it was difficult.
Ahora ya hay una un reconocimiento a esta representación de y lo que es importante es que la forma enmascarada y que este tipo de forma de lucha es pacífica. Mientras está Super Barrio, hay una idea de paz pública que trata de no alterarse.
It's an important thing is that every time Super Barrio is present, people know that there will not be violence. So the struggle is peaceful. So when people see Super Barrio, they'll know that they'll be defended, but in a peaceful way.
So when you decided to make the movie, why did you bring the... how did you decide on the genre of the movie, which is this interesting combination?
We talked a lot about it, and just the content of the movie being so incredible. You know, it's just a real movie, it's a documentary, and people are basically taking their whole personality out of a comic book. So we started with that, and it's like, well, it just kind of lent itself to use animation and try to emulate how we perceive superheroes, which is through animation. So,
and the animation morphs into real life and vice versa.
Exactly, which is pretty much what these guys do. I mean, they use the kind of like the collective of people, the ideas they have of superheroes, and just put it in reality to advance their causes. So,
well, all of this is Super Amigos, Super Barrio, Super Gay, Super Animal, Fray Tormenta, and Ecologista Universal. And it's full of subtitles, and everybody can understand it. It's mostly in Spanish. And it screens, let's see, today at 7:15 at the Center for... No, that was yesterday.
It was yesterday.
Yesterday at the Center for Contemporary Arts, OL.
Saturday.
And Saturday at 1:30 in the afternoon. And I want to thank you very much, Arturo Pérez Torres.
Thank you.
And Super Barrio for being with us.
Esperamos en la película.
Muchas gracias.
Gracias.
We're going to take another break right now. We'll be right back. Stay tuned to KSFR. I'd like now to welcome Jonathan Blitzstein. He is a filmmaker who wrote and directed a film called Let Them Chirp a While, and we are also joined by actress Pepper Binkley, who is in the film, and composer Julio Carmas. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Hi, how are you?
Hello.
It's a terrific and quite hilarious film about a young aspiring filmmaker who's trying to come up with some ideas, and they're sometimes rather awkward. How autobiographical, I just have to ask you, is this film?
Of course. I get asked that question all the time.
I'm sure.
It's not really autobiographical. I guess I've been living in New York for 7 years, and I went to film school. Obviously, I wrote the script for this movie, so the struggle of being a sort of first-time screenwriter, I know what that's like. But in terms of everything that happens to the characters and those relationships and stuff, it was all sort of a fantasy, sort of like a created caricature of life in the East Village based on conversations with people that I had. And it was sort of a combination of a lot of my friends and people that I know or I'd heard about. So I guess not so autobiographical.
Well, a lot of it is relationships among various people. Pepper plays a girl who's been going out with this man who's really kind of lost, and she's been very loyal to him for a number of years, and he's not that great a guy. Tell us more about your character.
You know, Johnny and I have talked a lot about what the movie's about, and I think when we go back and look at it, it's really a buddy movie. And she's this girl who has made her life about her boyfriend, and her boyfriend has made his life about nothing. So when he disappears, then she also takes on this completely lost soul, or realizes that she's this completely lost soul. And I think she spends much of the movie searching for what it is that she might do in the absence of someone to follow.
And the other main character, the other guy, not the boyfriend, but his buddy, is also kind of lost, very amiable. Mm-hmm. And the only person who's not lost is a guy who's quite a successful playwright, and he's a completely unappealing character.
Right.
I guess that sort of the Hart Carlton character that I wrote, it was sort of my... cynical, somewhat satirical comment about the art scene and that the people who are, you know, in this case, he sort of steals the 9/11 stuff and incorporates that in his play and then takes the idea from his friend and sort of cashes in on that. And I wanted to sort of make a comment about how a lot of times it just happens that way, that the people who are making material that's not original and not new and often stolen from other people are the people who find success. And it's a crapshoot, and you never know who's going to make it one day and who's going to make it the next. And I think at the end, of course, Bobby and Scott's characters spiral downward into oblivion and their relationships fall apart and it's a mess. But in the end, there's sort of that comment that, oh, Hart's play didn't really, it's not going to get a big theatrical run, and it was all sort of hype, which is, it sort of comes full circle. And those kinds of people who have that big project and all that stuff end up sometimes in the end just being a lot of hype. So it's sort of funny that way.
Now, one of the characters in the movie, to my great delight, is Jack Russell Terrier.
Mm-hmm.
Well, he does steal a lot of scenes, that little guy.
It's very funny because the main guy is Bobby, mm-hmm. Is charged with taking care of this terrier, loses it, and thinks he could just get another one that looks like it and give it back to the person.
Yeah, that's a movie. That's a little bit of movie magic. Sort of stretch the imagination to accept that, I guess. But that's the one autobiographical thing in the film. I did take care of someone's dog. It was not a Jack Russell, but the dog drove me nuts, and I always had
you
that in the back
of
my mind.
You took care of someone's Jack Russell with the hope that you would be able to sleep with her when she came back.
Yeah, that was
subconscious.
Yeah, exactly. That was his subconscious.
That's a different layer of the story.
It was a smelly, bad dog, and it was for like, I think it was just a week, but I thought, wow.
But it seemed like 6 months.
It seemed like 6 months, and I thought it would be perfect.
You wanted to lose that dog.
Yeah. And I'm a big fan of the Italian neorealist filmmakers like Vittorio De Sica, who did this movie Umberto D from 1952. Yeah. It's a classic. It's about an old man taking care of a dog. It's a Jack Russell. And I wanted to sort of make a little throwback to that movie. And so having the character taking care of the dog was something that I really wanted to do.
Who are some of your other film inspirations? I couldn't help but think of Manhattan watching mm-hmm. this movie.
Yeah, I love Woody Allen. Surprisingly, before I made this movie, I hadn't seen nearly as many films as I saw after I finished it. I had seen Manhattan. I really like the way that Woody Allen romanticized New York City. In this one, I wanted to create a claustrophobic feeling of the grungy, dirty East Village and romanticize it among young people. Another film that I looked at was La Dolce Vita, and I love how Fellini does that film. I'm a big fan of Fellini, Woody Allen, Alfred Hitchcock, Stanley Kubrick, Tim Burton's early work like Beetlejuice and Pee Wee's Big Adventure are some of my favorite films. That whimsical sort of world, and also Steven Spielberg is a big hero of mine.
Did you watch The Brothers McMullen?
I actually haven't seen that film.
Oh, because your film reminded me of that.
I will definitely.
And you
check
haven't
out.
Even seen it.
That's
one of very few that Johnny hasn't seen. He's a cinephile.
Yeah, someone mentioned, was it an early Todd Solondz or an early Todd
yeah.
Solondz movie?
Yeah.
Like Fear and Anxiety or something.
Well, how did you manage to make an independent film? I mean, here we are at the Santa Fe Film Festival, and everybody is doing things on a shoestring and getting by. How'd you do it?
How did I do it? Well, I had worked in the industry for a long time. I PA'd on, I was a production assistant on tons of student films and shorts when I was at NYU. Then I graduated and worked in every single odd job you can imagine. I drove trucks. I was a boom operator. For a while, I wanted to be a director of photography, and so I was a camera assistant on some indie features. And then I worked as a set dresser and everything and learned all these sort of crafts and was working on script writing. And then I did this one film that I was a production assistant on called No Reservations with Aaron Eckhart and Catherine Zeta-Jones, and that was sort of a different project. It was a big studio film that was shooting in New York in a big soundstage at Silver Cup Studios, and when I finished that one, I felt that it was time for me to try and make my own thing, so I had the script that I finished, and I originally it was supposed to be a black and white, I'd heard about Andrew Bujalski, and I'd seen Funny Ha Ha, what he had done, and I was like, wow, I should just make a low-budget indie feature. And then as the project kept moving forward and I met people who were interested, the people who had said to me, when you make your first film, Jonathan, you should call us. We'll help you out. And I thought, okay, this person's going to give me a light or something. And those people gave us trucks of lights. And my producer, Anouk Frosch, was fabulous. She's now the vice president of Steiner Studios, which is the biggest production soundstage on the Eastern Seaboard. It's enormous. It takes up the whole Brooklyn Navy Yards. But we just campaigned to people. Kodak donated all the film for free. We shot on 35mm, which was never supposed to happen. We shot on color. I thought this was going to be a tiny little film. And then with casting, it was sort of like I was going to cast my friends, and then I had this project, and I had a little bit of money left over, and I said, why don't we throw it at actors? And so we started cold calling agents. I literally picked up the phone and called up, you know, the Gersh Agency or Paradigm, and I said, okay, here's this project. Who are your actors who live in New York who might want to read this? And I begged people to look at it, and they did, and people liked it, and that's how I ended up getting some awesome people like Laura Breckenridge, who's coming out with a new movie, a picture house film called Amusement, that's going to be a big thriller, and Zach Galligan from Gremlins, who's a hero of mine. I'm a big 80s film fan. I love Joe Dante. And so getting all those people, and somehow it sort of came together. And the movie, it looks like it cost a lot of money, and it
was
made
indeed.
For whatever you think it costs, divide that by five, and that's sort of what it actually cost.
Well, it's a wonderful film. It's called Let Them Chirp a While, and it screens on Sunday at the Santa Fe Film Center at 1 in the afternoon, and you will all be there?
Yeah.
Yeah, we'll be here.
Good.
We can do a Q&A, and we hope everyone comes. It's a really fun drama comedy.
It is hilarious and really fun to watch, and it has a good dog in it.
And Julia's.
And Julio's Wonder Woman, we haven't even barely talked about.
Julio, I'll just quickly say, Julio wrote the whole score for this film.
And it's
I told
terrific.
Him that I wanted a Nino Rota Gershwin type score, and he sat down and just did it, and it's amazing. And the movie is wall-to-wall music, and it wouldn't have been so amazing without him. So,
Jonathan Blitzstein, Julio Carmas, and Pepper Binkley, thanks for being with us.
Thank you so much.
Bye.
We're going to take one more break. Stay tuned to KSFR. And I'd like now to welcome D.B. Sweeney. He is the writer, director, producer, and actor of a film called Two Tickets to Paradise. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you very much. Great to be here.
Nice to have you. Now, this is a road movie about three guys who are going from Pennsylvania to Florida to see a football game for which they only have two tickets. And it's kind of a coming-of-age movie, except the guys are around 40.
Yeah, these are three guys who had incredible success in high school and early college, a football player. One guy was a valedictorian, the other guy was a very successful local musician. And, you know, they were superstars in their small town, and it just never panned out for them. So they sort of forestalled the inevitable maturation that comes with growing up and sort of stayed in their comfort zone. And I think it's that's where the universality of the movie comes in, because something like 97% of all Americans settle within 50 miles of where they were born. And, we tend to stick around home, and I think everybody knows the person who is the superstar in high school, and that person generally doesn't become Tom Brady.
Most likely to succeed.
Yeah. And, there's only, I like to say, there's 30,000 high school quarterbacks in America every year. And there's one Brett Favre, there's 30,000 valedictorians, there's one Bill Gates. What happens to everybody else? And so this movie's a little bit about being okay with life setting in and giving you a little reality sandwich.
And so they drive down from Pennsylvania to Florida, and it really, it's a real guy movie.
Oh, well.
It's like a window into stuff that, conversations that like never happen when I'm around, they're
right.
having in the car.
Yeah, we found it's been funny. I know you say it's a guy movie, but we found incredible success with women in the audience because they feel like, as you say, like they're like a fly on the wall.
Yeah.
Like you're the fourth person in the car. And I think that what we were going for, my co-writer Brian Curry and I, is that it's guys aren't as bad as you think when it's just guys, and they're not as good as you think. And it's a little different than the way you might expect it to play out.
And they also do very strange things, like inadvertently burning people's house down and then saying, oh, well.
Yeah, one fella is very obsessed with Vanna White, and in an attempt to pay her an homage, they do destroy her house. And, metaphorically, it's sort of like they have to burn down their childhood in a way to grow up. So, but it's a fun movie, and, this is a great film festival. I know a lot of people that go to a lot of film festivals know that a lot of times you have to sit through very arty movies, especially by first-time directors, and I've really tried to make this as entertaining as possible and as much about the audience as about, the filmmakers.
It is indeed very entertaining to watch. And it'd be fun to watch. I've been watching all these movies on a small television set, and this is one that'd be fun to watch on a big screen.
Yeah, comedies, it's tricky when you send your movie around to movie studios and stuff and they watch it on a computer screen or a DVD player, because a comedy, there's an infectious aspect of it where when it starts to work and the audience is all sort of laughing together, that it takes on a different life. So I'm very excited for people to see it tonight at the Film Center.
Yeah, so it's tonight at the Film Center at 8:15 and then again on Saturday at 3:15 at the Santa Fe Film Center. tell us about the people who acted in it. There's, well, Ed Harris is one known name. It's a very small role that he plays.
Yeah, he plays a small but pivotal role in the movie, and he's an old friend of mine, and I've known him since back in New York theater days in the 80s. John C. McGinley and I were both at NYU together. People know him as Dr. Cox on Scrubs and in a million other supporting roles, and here he has a chance to step to the center of the screen and be the main character, which is a great challenge for him, and a lot of people are saying it's the best thing he's ever done, which I take as a great compliment as a director. And we also have a lot of great supporting people like MC Gainey and Rex Lynn from CSI Miami and Mark Moses, and just a lot of familiar faces. I didn't want to put in a bunch of like celebrity cameos, but I did want to call on my 20 years of relationships in the business to get some of what I think of some of the best character actors in the business to encounter these guys on the road.
Now, you won the award of Best Director at the Boston International Film Festival. This is the first movie that you've directed?
Yes, it is. First one I've written, first one I've directed, and first one I've produced. So I just jumped in with both feet on this, and we've had some tremendous success. We won at Savannah and Vail, and the movie's had some great acknowledgement at the film festivals, which is unusual because a lot of times film festivals, they want to pick movies that are either that have a social message or a political message. And, I think that people feel like film festivals should be very different from the movies that they would see at multiplexes. So for a movie like mine, which is not really a Hollywood movie, but it is a movie that could play at a multiplex, it's a great compliment to get this recognition. So we're really grateful.
It is my heart's desire that the best movies at film festivals would play at multiplexes, because I think it would change American culture for the better.
Yeah, there's just a very fundamental disconnect between the distributors of the big six Hollywood studios. They think that anybody who's going to the movies is under 30 and stupid, and they will take whatever, as long as Jessica Alba's in it and there's some visual effects, that they'll go. And it's unfortunate, because there are movies I've seen on this festival circuit that would play very well. Maybe they wouldn't play on 3,000 screens, but they could certainly play on 700 or 1,000 screens and do very well.
The film is called Two Tickets to Paradise. I have to ask you something, and again, it's a sort of maybe perhaps male psychology question. What is this about sacrificing your automobile? I noticed that in the movie Sideways and in yeah. your movie.
Well, I think that, as a guy, when you getting your license, it's important for girls too, but I grew up in New York, and when you're 16 years old, you go get your learner's permit and you try to get your license as quickly as you can, and it's sort of like the first step towards being a grown-up. And then once you have that license, getting your own car is sort of like finally severing the umbilical cord. So I think that first car and that identification with the first car is very much a part of male psyche and the male teenager experience. So the fact that John McGinley's character has held on to the same car for 30 years and that he finally has to, give it up is what sets him free to, leave the emotional nest, as it were.
And so, it's part of the coming-of-age process.
Yes, and it's taken them 25 years, but they're finally getting along with it. The other thing that I think people might respond to in the movie is I was very fortunate to get some incredible music in the movie. I have songs from Bruce Springsteen and Bob Dylan and Dire Straits. And these artists, if they were to charge me what they charge a Hollywood studio, I could never have afforded any of them. But Bruce Springsteen endorsed the movie, and so that, when you can say we have a Bruce Springsteen song, how can you give us another song for the same price? People don't really negotiate with you. So it was really a great thing. And, we have music from Stevie Ray Vaughan and Emmylou Harris and just really good classic rock and roll, road music. So very excited about that aspect of it working out.
Well, D.B. Sweeney, I want to thank you for coming in, and congratulations on your first movie, very successful and very amusing and interesting to watch. Two Tickets to Paradise today at 8:15 at the Santa Fe Film Center, Saturday at 3:15 as well. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you. I'll be there tonight after the movie to answer questions and say hi to people if they want to come by. So I hope to see a lot of people there.
Excellent. You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe, and this is our fourth day of filmmakers from the Santa Fe Film Festival. Tomorrow is Friday. We're going to have a few more filmmakers, and Robert Knott will be with us speaking of the arts. My name is Mary Charlotte. KSFR streams live on the web at ksfr.org. You can email me at radiocafe@ksfr.org or leave a message at 428-1528. We're also podcasting. The website is santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can listen to the show anytime you want, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services. And you can also subscribe to the show on iTunes. Thanks to Laurel Reynolds for engineering today. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team. And after that, Good Morning Jazz features Artist of the Month, Shorty Rogers, and his Martian tunes in the 11 a.m. hour. Broadcasting live from the Santa Fe Baking Company, my name is Mary Charlotte. We will see you tomorrow. Ciao.